WBAI New York. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Good morning, and thank you so very much for tuning in. It is 9 a.m. here in New York City. Coming up next, Law of the Land. Please stay tuned. By the way, The Gothamist is reporting that more children were killed last year by vehicles in New York City than any year since the launch of the Street Safety Initiative Vision Zero, a new analysis found, calling into question Mayor Eric Adams's claim about improving street safety. There will be more ahead. Please stay tuned.
Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree, but with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry, and then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul. More than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you.
Morning greetings, everyone. Welcome again. I'm Linda McDonald Carter. I'm sitting in for Gloria Brown Marshall this morning, who will see you on the radio next week. As you may know, I'm a retired professor at Essex County College. I taught American government, criminal justice, paralegal studies, and political science. I am also a member of the Association of Black Women Lawyers, particularly the co-chair of the Social Justice Committee. I really welcome everyone, and I'm so looking forward to the show this morning. We're going to have an interview with Commissioner Giles H. Shipp. He's the commissioner, or one of the commissioners, of New Jersey Police Training Commission, which is responsible for the development and certification of basic training courses for county, local police, sheriff's officers, state and county correction officers. But before we join Commissioner Giles Shipp, as usual, I talk about everyday activism and just remind people of the power that they have. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that if you remember, especially those of you in New York, Governor Hochul didn't win that election by too many. As a matter of fact, many would say that if it wasn't for the Working Party and their efforts and work to get people out, that 4 or 5% that the governor won by would not have happened. Who knows what happened before? So that's an example of people getting out and recognizing what their power is. The idea now is to make her accountable for that 5% that helped pull her over for her win. Anyway, getting to voting. As you know, I always talk about how we all have a constitutional right to vote, but showing up at polls is not enough. Excuse me. There are other important matters to consider and you can act upon perhaps while you're waiting online, checking your cell phone, washing clothes at the laundromat, or any time you remain still for a few minutes or so. So let's talk about what we should think about. We should think about, who are we voting for? Are we voting for a person or are we voting for a party? Who or what entity or organization is funding that person's elections campaign? And that's really important because that lets you know who has their ear and influence. Also, what influence you need to neutralize. You can find out who is supporting them financially by going in New York to the New York State Board of Elections, in New Jersey Election Law Enforcement Commission. You can also go to the Federal Elections Commission. And there's a nonprofit called opensecrets.org, which you probably get more information from about who's funding a campaign, because that's really, really important in terms of who the elected officials are going to owe after they get in office. What about the candidate? Is the candidate knowledgeable about the issues? That's really important. Are they knowledgeable about the issues or are they just running because they're looking for a paycheck? Is that person knowledgeable and well-informed and able to articulate a strategy resulting in changing conditions, not, you know, seeking to transform conditions in your community, rather than maintain the status quo through reform? And that's really important. Consistency. Does the person have a proven track record in social justice and advocacy, or whatever you think is important to you? Is it important that the person have some sense of spirituality? Should they have a willingness to surround themselves with competent, intelligent, principled, and committed people that represent the good you want to see in your community? Is the individual courageous and resilient? Does the candidate have a demonstrated record of community or political courage and resiliency? That's important for us to know. On another note, and I want to give credit because I think this is such a good idea, and I just heard it the other day on another WBI program with Bob Laws on the ground, where he mentioned that the community must select the candidates. That, you know, that's something for us to think about. How do we select the candidates as opposed to having other people select the candidates for us? Really important. Maybe you might consider a meeting at the local public library. And, you know, call your neighbors together and let's sit down and think about, you know, what do you want to do? And now is the time to do it. Not wait until right before the election, but 3 or 4 years before the election. It's really important to start on the ground in advance of right before the election, because then it becomes a scramble to try to figure out what we're going to do, where we're going to go, how we're going to make this happen. But start planning now. Start strategizing now. If you decide you're not happy with an elected official, start strategizing now. And all it takes is to talk to your neighbors. If you're in a high rise or you're in a place in a development or a community where you can reach out to people, start talking to them. Just say, good morning. You know, what's going on? What do you think about this? It's a conversation. It's an empowerment conversation if you let it be that. Again, don't wait until the powers determine who will run and who will get your vote. But you get a chance in your individual capacity and your collective community to start getting folks together now. Anyway, on that note, we're going to move forward and we're going to move forward to talk to and interview Commissioner Giles Shipp. Michael, music, please.
Playback.
Listen if you're missing, y'all. Swinging while I'm singing. Hey! Giving what you're getting. Knowing what I'm knowing. While the black band's sweating. In the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need. Hey! Our freedom of speech is freedom of flesh. We got to fight the battles that beat. Fight the power. Fight the power. realize the prize arrives. We got the pump, the stuff to make the drop. From the heart, it's a start, a work of art to revolutionize. Make a change, something great. People, we all the same. No, we're not the same, because we don't know the game. What we need is awareness. We can't get careless. You say, what is this? All the loving. Let's get down to business. Mental, self-defense, or fitness.
Michael, thank you very much. So, you know, that was a song that was selected by our guest to be interviewed this morning, Commissioner Giles Shipp. I've known Commissioner Giles Shipp before he was commissioner, so I'm going to call him Giles. But everyone else call him commissioner because he's really doing a great job. As a matter of fact, I think the state of New Jersey would probably try to circumvent him, but he's going to tell us what our power is to make sure they can't do this to him. So on that note, Commissioner, do you mind providing the audience with a brief bio of yourself and some highlights in terms of how you came to this point and an overview of the purpose and function of the New Jersey Police Training Commission, of which you're a commissioner on?
No, absolutely. And good morning. And thank you for having me. First and foremost, for the purposes of this conversation, I'd like everybody to know I served over 17 years in a predominantly suburban community. I say predominantly because the community had everything in it from $3 million homes to public housing projects and everything in between. One of the most diverse cities in the state of New Jersey, the fifth largest municipality, Edison, New Jersey. I started off there as a patrol officer after I came out of my service with the United States Marine Corps and also college undergraduate. Since that time, I was asked to serve at the Attorney General's office with the Attorney General, and that was about 2002. In 2002, I served at the Attorney General's office under six different Attorney Generals, including the first African-American Attorney General, Peter C. Harvey, the former AUSA, and as well as very active private practice. In addition to that, I served as the Director of Public Safety for the City of Plainfield, New Jersey. My responsibilities there was to oversee the administration of the Police Department, Fire Department, and the Office of Emergency Management. And after I completed my service at in that area, then I became a member of the Police Training Commission. And that was done by an act of the legislature. Since its inception in 1961, they've never had an African-American to sit on that board in the state of New Jersey. So it was a first. We created a position for organization who I oversaw for, I was just thinking about the other day, for over 20 years now, organization called NOBLE, which is an acronym for the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. I currently serve as the state chapter president, and I was formerly the international president, where I served over 55 chapters throughout the United States, the Caribbean, and the UK. NOBLE is an organization of federal, state, county, and municipal law enforcement executives. In order to be a regular member, you have to be a chief commander or somebody in the executive level of law enforcement. Been around since 1976. Proud to say our first national president was the police director of Newark, New Jersey, Hubert Williams. So that's just to give you a little backdrop on my law enforcement career. I've met with president, vice president, attorney general of the United States on law enforcement matters. I served on a number of mayor's transition teams on the public safety area, and at least three governor's transition teams. So I guess you could say I'm pretty well versed in the area of public safety. But that being said, I currently, as I said, serve on the PTC, which is New Jersey Police Training Commission, which promulgates all of the training and certifies all law enforcement members in the state of New Jersey. So I guess that's a thumbnail sketch, Professor Carter, of my background in the field of law enforcement that's relative to the discussion that we're going to have today.
Right. So I really appreciate that. If you can give, in terms of New Jersey and training, and talk about whether or not we have improved, at least in the time that you've been here, and to what degree, and kind of give the audience an idea of what's involved when you, you know, what should they be expecting in terms of the public? What should they be expecting from the Police Training Commission?
Absolutely. But if I could just, beg your pardon just for 1 minute. I know you brought up Governor Hochul in New York. And, you know, a lot of folks may not know, and you really get me going when you start talking about civics and our civic responsibility. and I love it, because that's what, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. And Governor Hochul, well, I should say the state of New Jersey and the state of New York, are red states. They're red states. You know what make those states blue? Black people. All right. Black people make those states blue, and we're not taking enough advantage of that. The first thing she did, and it's coming up, going to be in her budget address that she said she was going to do, Governor Hochul, is to criminalize menthol cigarettes. Now, we all know who smoke menthol cigarettes. And quite frankly, menthol cigarettes is not our problems. We want guns off the streets. We want to interrupt aggravated sexual assaults. We want to stop burglaries. We have a host of Schedule I crimes that we need to pay attention to. And she is bringing up the menthol issue. Why is that so important? People might say, first of all, I can't believe it, because they're not banning. They don't want to ban all cigarettes. They just want to ban menthol cigarettes. And the problem I have with that, over 85% of the people that smoke menthol cigarettes are African-American and Latino people. So subsequently, what does that do? Excuse me. That will now give law enforcement an additional reason as to why they can engage African-American or Latino people. It's not necessary. We know that strong police community relations and efficiency, fairness, and effective policing reduces the rate of crime. Not that. If you're going to ban cigarettes, in no way, shape, or form would I promote the smoking of cigarettes, any type of cigarettes. But if you're going to ban them all. Just don't ban the one that majority of Black people and Latinos smoke. So I just wanted to put that out there when we're talking about, you know, fairness. We're talking about what direction law enforcement goes. There, any time a law is made, we fail to look at the unintended consequences that go along with that law as well. So I'm sorry. I just had to.
That's okay. We have these kind of conversations. So I want you to go back to the red and blue state, because this goes in terms of Black people and other people of color in this country turning out to vote, to understand that we determine, not only in New York and New Jersey, I mean, we're not exactly a blue country either. Mm-hmm. So we've always made the difference, particularly for the Democrats. So I won't talk about partisan politics, but we'll just talk about red and blue. And the fact that what you're talking about in terms of those cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
It's an illusion, sort of like, you know, we're doing something for your community, but that requires us to become educated about these things too. And I think the first thing, and I'm glad you said, is we must understand, particularly Black people in these two states, that the only reason why it's even given the perception of being blue is because of us. And if we don't turn out to, if we don't become knowledgeable in terms of our civic responsibility, that's first and foremost, because otherwise people just have you voting when they want you to vote and then go away. So you can speak a little bit more to that, because I was glad that you brought that up.
Yes. You know, as the great Adam Clayton Powell, a former congressman, said, you know, the power is in your hands. And we put these people into office and I'm not going to pull any punches with it. We put these people in the office, and rarely, very rarely, if at all, do we get anything back in return for that for that opportunity that we gave them to serve.
It's the opportunity, or it's really the power that we're giving to them. We're giving them power.
Yes.
Right. All right. Well, we'll move on to the issue at hand, but I just wanted to spend a little time on that since you brought it up. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you could talk a little bit more in detail in terms of what people should expect. First of all, what the PTC, the Police Training Commission, does, you know, what their jurisdiction is, what their scope of responsibilities, and in particular, you know, what do we need to know to make them accountable? And especially in New Jersey, since you're there, what can we do to give you more power to be able to influence things that are going to impact us in terms of our community?
Well, one thing that we need to do a better job in, as a community, for that matter, is to actually lift our voices. You know, we need to go to city hall meetings. All politics are local. We need to go to city hall meetings. We need to go to Board of Education meetings, and we need to put our concerns on the floor. We also need to organize. And when people don't respond to us, we need to move them out of office and put in people in office who are going to actually go in a direction that we feel that city, that county, or that state needs to go in. Let me give you an example of how critical, why that's so critical. One, over the last 4 years, it's been more televised, the problems that we're having in the field of law enforcement with trust, legitimacy, and we're trying to look for more transparency, and we're trying to look for transformative policing. Who do you think picks the chief of police for every town or the police director? It's the mayor. All right. So the mayor has a lot of say in who's going to be making those critical decisions. But until we go to those meetings, go to those either city hall, town hall meetings, and let them know how we feel or who we want to serve in that capacity, we're going to continue to get the same results. So that's critically important. We've been able to do a few things. I know you asked me about this earlier, excuse me, at the Attorney General's office. We've been able to enact a couple of pieces of legislation. One that's important is an independent prosecutor's bill. And I have to thank Assemblywoman Brittany Timberlake for spearheading that effort. And prosecutors didn't want it to happen. Police unions didn't want it to happen, but fortunately we were able to get it through. New York has a similar bill. New York has a similar structure in place now as well, but we were able to get it codified in New Jersey, and it's now in the law. Anytime there is a police encounter that results in a death, or if you're in police custody and it results in a death, now it should be taken out of the local prosecutor's hands or the county prosecutor's hands and handled by the Attorney General's office. That gives a better sense of independence to the community members who have, quite frankly, lost trust in many of their local police departments and don't even look at those entities as a legitimate organization anymore. You know, people may argue, but the facts are what they are. This is not something I'm making up. This is something that Poland has showed us and told us. So we have to be more involved in that effort to determine who's going to be policing us. We're one of the only communities where we don't pick who's going to be policing us. Not only should we be there for that position as the chief executive officer of that particular municipality, but we need to be there also when they're hiring people. All right. There is no law that says the community members can't be at the table when you're determining who's going to work for your community. You know, we like to look at the like to use in law enforcement, a person who they consider the father of modern day policing, Pelion. And Pelion had principles. And one of his principles were that the community are the police and the police are the community. So if that's the case, then why is that not happening? Why is the community feeling like it's a closed organization? So the only way we're going to prevent that from happening is being active and tearing down that wall, quite frankly.
Okay, so now if you can give us some more details about the PDC, particularly, yeah. A little bit about the guidelines to the extent, something general.
Yes.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
One of the things we've been able to do with the PCC recently, and that's with the support of one of our former attorney generals, we now have licensing in the state of New Jersey. We also are going to take account of any time there is a law enforcement encounter, and now it has to go into a database. So we have created a dashboard now so that even the public has access to what charges a law enforcement officer may have on him based on a citizen's complaint. And if now also we were able to change policy so that in fact, you go to your local internal affairs department and that internal affairs department is not responsive to you within 30 days, you can go directly to the attorney general's office to in turn find out what's the results or what is the status of that investigation. And they have to respond to you. But the dashboard will really be a big help too, and hopefully will deter officers from going rogue, because it'll be transparent and you'll be able to see how many complaints a particular officer had. And if it's major, it's very different categories of complaints against officers, but and the results, if it's a major suspension, you'll be able to see that as well. We want it to be totally transparent, but of course you get pushback from the unions. And if the community is not in there to push back the other way, which is all too many times it's happening, ultimately, it's not going to be in the best interest of the community, the results. So that's something that's really good that's happening. So more transparency. Is it enough? We could debate that issue, but we are at least moving in the right direction.
I was going to say that it's moving and it's better than it had been, and you're putting things out there. Now is to convince the media, because, there's a difference between, I always tell people, there's a difference between media and press. Media's job is to advertise, do commercials, public relations. The press's job, based on what the Constitution has given it, is to act as the fourth estate to make sure people know when government is not responsive to them. And that's the gift of BAI. They're more of a press. They don't have money to be media. As a matter of fact, that's something we want people to do. We want you to donate to BAI so you can hear people like Commissioner Schiff tell you what you need to do, let you know what's going on, because the other sources are used for that. I really appreciate it.
All of this information that I'm giving you, it's not secret. You can go to the New Jersey Attorney General's website and you can pull up this information. I'm sure, Attorney General Tish James is a very transparent individual as well. And I'm pretty sure you should be able to go to New York Attorney General website and get the information as to what's going on and what resources are available to you as well. But this is not confidential information.
Right.
This is information that's available to the public if you know where to go get it.
Right. And I was going to say that I'm sure they may be counting how many people are checking this website, so that they want to know how many people know this information. So I encourage people in New Jersey, particularly, to go on the website as much as possible. I don't care if you have to go individually 100 times, because they're going to be counting to see whether or not they should keep it up in the first place, whether or not people really care about it. So that's really important. So, okay, so we're going to go back. What else do we need to know about the training? and the training standards? What should we know as the public? So when we see police out there, we'll say, you know, that doesn't look like that falls within the training. You know, something simple. We don't need to know all the specifics, but something that's like, oh, he's falling out of training. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, what most of the cases that and the calls that we get to Noble are generally most of them are use of force. And unfortunately, there are also a lot of demeanor complaints that people may have encountered. But unfortunately, many times they don't follow up with it. You know, it's critically important that if you feel you've been mistreated or treated unfairly by a law enforcement officer. Me, as a law enforcement executive, when I was the head of Plainfield PD, which is a mid-sized urban center, I wanted to know who that individual was, because I have too many other important things to worry about than an officer that I'm paying a good salary to that is out there in the streets mistreating the public who we sworn to protect and serve. So don't think that you're inconveniencing someone. But if you have even a demeanor complaint or you have any other type of complaint, let us know. And quite frankly, there's nothing more that a good cop hates than a bad cop. Because for all of the good work that you do in the community, that person can erode the confidence back for years and years based on their mistreatment. So that system is in place. And you need to take advantage of it. I don't care, as I said, if it's even a demeanor complaint, if it's a use of force complaint, let us know. But with respect to the use of force complaint, what we have been able to do in New Jersey now, that is being more closely monitored. Anytime force is used, there has to be a actual report that's rendered to the Attorney General's office. Within a short period of time. One of the other things that I've noticed also with the use of force complaints, it usually happens in most cases when you have law enforcement officers. This is something that I'm trying to push for now, and even a legislator has proposed a bill. One of the things that we know in law enforcement, when people are more physically fit, their mental acuity is higher, we know that they're less likely to get involved in a force complaint, believe it or not. And we know also people are less likely to challenge them. So we are pushing now, and it's going to be a tough fight. We're pushing now for law enforcement officers to have annual PFTs, annual physical fitness tests.
What should we do? What can we do? Because, you know, I'm really into taking care of myself since God has given me this body. I think in due respect to God, I need to be taking care of my body. So what can we do to make sure that this happens? What can your audience, individually and collective, do? And give them numbers, please, if yes. You know them.
Correct. Well, everything is now, you can pull everything up through Google. More information than I ever wanted to pull up is located in Google now. But call up your state assembly persons and your state senators and let them know that you feel that people should be physically fit. Quite frankly, there's a bill Senator Bergen out of Morris County had introduced a bill for that. So the hardest part of the work is already done. You just need now other legislators to sign on to that and support that bill and to bring it into fruition.
You know what? Having said that, do you think, and this may not be the case, it just came to me, that some people, because they're lazy and they're not fit, that they may be shooting and causing harm to people at a distance because they're not fit?
Yes, absolutely. That's one aspect that I left out too. Usually we find, and this is nationally, we usually find that people who are less fit are more apt to go to their weapon as a first line of defense. When it's many cases, it's not even necessary, or go to some type of weapon as a first line of defense. Very tragic case just happened out in Ohio, and I encourage everyone to Google it. African-American female went into a McDonald's to buy a hamburger or some type of hamburger, Big Mac or something, and it was no cheese on it. She went back into the store, like any consumer should do, and complain that I paid you for cheese and there's no cheese on it. And from all that I know, she did it in a very professional way. Subsequently, the manager said, no problem, we'll correct it, give you another burger. The cook decided that he didn't want to make another burger for her and came around the counter and started engaging the woman. The woman subsequently left the store, went to go sit back in her car, and the manager decided to call the police. Police came, the woman got out of her vehicle, started explaining to the officers what happened, and they were insisting upon her, giving her identification. And subsequently, the woman was pushed up against a police car, battered, had a taser pointed at her, and aggressively hit in the face, and to the point where she has significant extensive injuries now, and then was arrested because of a 30-cent piece of cheese that the establishment did not put on her food. And so subsequently, she's now traumatized for life. Okay, I pray that her recuperation goes well. She has about 5 teeth that are loosened. She has now fractures in her face. She has a swollen lip. And all of this because of somebody's ego. And I can tell you, if you see the video, fortunately, somebody captured the video because the officer's cameras only showed when she was speaking in a calm demeanor. And for some reason, when he engaged her, there was no cameras. Cameras is another thing that we have put into place, that we've pushed to get put into place to create also another level of transparency. And if they're not creating that level of transparency, we need to review what we're doing with the cameras as well. But I wanted to bring that the camera piece in there because people think that cameras are like a panacea. No, cameras only work if they're properly operated. So, but yeah, that's a very tragic incident that occurred. And oftentimes we think of the initial injuries and we don't think about the trauma that a person now will suffer for the rest of their lives. And African-American people are more susceptible to Alzheimer's and other type of ailments. And with too many, if you have to see this, I'm going to tell you right now, if it was my sister, I know I would have gotten in trouble. And if, even if I was there on that scene, I would have gotten in trouble because the way that officer was battering her, now he's on administrative leave. And, you know, the quote unquote investigation has begun. But a classic example of excessive force. If you had three male officers out there and you can't control one woman or you can't take a woman into custody, there's a lot of techniques that we have that we should be using. Pressure point control tactics. You can put people in arm bars. There's physical force that could be used to, if needed, I'm not even saying that it raised up to that level, but if it was needed, it could be applied. You don't have to point a taser at somebody's face to get them to comply. First of all, I could have communicated with the woman and I would have saw what her situation was and then went back into the restaurant. There was so many failures on that particular incident. You know, somebody needs to pay for that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. When we talk about use of force, police abuse. There are a couple of incidents, and you spoke to the one in Ohio that I want you to talk to the audience about. And I'm going to do something for the audience. I'm going to do something different I never did before. We're going to skip a break because what Commissioner Giles is saying, the information he's giving us to work with and to follow up on is so critical. Not that my other interviews haven't been, but I think this one is real important, especially because all the things that happened so quickly in the last week or so. So I wanted Commissioner Giles to speak to the incident in Memphis, Tennessee, if he knows about it, and also Atlanta, because Atlanta, I believe, involved Black police officers, right? If I'm correct?
Memphis did,
right. And I want you to speak to what is it that Black police officers are trying to prove, and if possible, I don't know if we have enough time because that may be a long conversation.
Let me just say this, if I may. to me, Black is more than just a color, all right? Just because someone shares your pigmentation doesn't mean they're culturally competent. All right. So, so we throw that word around. But you know, if you're not culturally competent, to me, it doesn't matter who you bring on the police department. You're going to get the same results because many times we get indoctrinated to the systematic or the systemic problems that are in policing, for example. And I want to be clear, you know, there are good police out there that are doing the right thing. But when you have people who are irresponsible, people who probably should have never been police officers, taking the law into their own hands, there needs to be a price to pay for that. And fortunately, in Memphis, Tennessee, the five African-American officers that were involved in that incident, currently right now, we have a police director in Memphis, Tennessee, who I'm proud to say was a past Noble national president. She started out her career in law enforcement in Atlanta, Georgia, came up to the rank of deputy chief. She went to Durham for a while as the chief, and then subsequently now she is the director of police for the city of Memphis. She made the determination that these individuals were going to be terminated. The problem is we don't have enough directors with the intestinal fortitude like her and many other agencies, because if you're responsible for a person's death and it wasn't in the line of duty, you don't need to be in the policing profession. So I guess the courts are going to determine the next steps, but I have to applaud her because she took the right first steps. And now it's up to the courts to determine what the next steps are going to be. But it's critically important that, and see, that's just a perfect example why it's so critically important that the community is involved in the selection of who's going to be the CEO of their law enforcement agency.
And you're absolutely right. And I'm glad you talked about just because you have a certain color doesn't mean you have cultural competency, but it also brings the point that regardless, you're a Black person in America. So whatever your status, these things can potentially happen to you. And I think we all need to be mindful that it doesn't matter, as some of us know from doing the height of COVID with the doctor, and I believe Atlanta, Georgia, who was in front of his house about to go and help people around the issue of COVID. And his wife had to come and prove to a police officer that he lived there. So whatever our status, unfortunately, some of us think we're different, but we're probably the only people that folks see in the collective, no matter what, no matter what. So anyway,
you also better believe too, that if you are in a police department, and you think those traditional unions are going to back you up as a Black police officer the way they back other people up, you got another thought coming.
That's true. That's true. So I wanted to talk. I don't know if a lot of our audience is really familiar with what's going on in Atlanta, Georgia, with this whole issue of Cop City. If you could speak to what's going on, because someone was recently, I'm going to say, executed or assassinated, who was trying to stop Cop City from being built. In a city where Martin Luther King came out, you know, speaking of Martin Luther King, he comes in nonviolence, and then you want to build Cop City in Atlanta, Georgia, of all places. But you want to speak to that, Commissioner?
Yes, from the information that I have, some conservationists were occupying an area where the colloquial term I think they're using is Cop City. I don't know what's the exact name of the project, but if it was Cop City, you're starting out in the wrong place to begin with. It should be called something more like a public safety training academy. You know, words matter. So, and I don't have information about that. I don't know how much information the people in the community have, but what I do know is that it was 85-acre parcel. And the governing body had approved $90 million for this project. And if that is the case, it should have been, I understand too, that it was limited discussion in the hearing, whether or not they were going to approve this. You know, you can't I thought we would have learned by now that when communities and police work together, you know, you get better results, you know, and it provides a opportunity for law enforcement leaders to do their work in the most efficient and effective way. So, you know, I don't know specifically all of the details, but what I do also know is one of the individuals that were in the conservation area shot at a law enforcement officer. In no way, shape, or form should you ever resort to violence to try to develop public policy. And I understand that fire was returned and the perpetrator of that shot was subsequently killed. So, you know, I don't know all the particulars around how this was all coming together or how the governing body, I think they approved it by a 10-4 vote. And
with Democrats and Republicans.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Democrat. And also, I think the defender was there, if I remember, because they're also taking over 381 acres of a forest. So it was sort of like a land defender who was on the site. And for what I've heard, again, is that police officer, that the person was shot, didn't have a weapon. I guess that'll come out later in terms of the investigation. So, because land defenders normally around the country, and they tend to be, and I'm not sure if this person was indigenous or not, but they don't tend to have weapons. So that was kind of interesting.
So. Well, I from the reports that I heard, and like I said, I'm not on the ground there. I'm just going from either spoken or written reports. They said sometime later, a gun was recovered.
So the whole idea of it, I know there's a Stop Cop City effort going on in Atlanta, Georgia, one before environmental reasons, but the other one is has a lot to do with this whole militarization in response to, and maybe you could speak to this whole militarization that's happening after George Floyd. You had all these protests about, you know, using funding for other reasons other than, you know, police, and now it's sort of flipped on its head where you have this, you know, more amplified policing going on in this country. And from what I understand, I don't know enough about it, that people are really fearing this Cop City because it's setting up a model for around the country. It's sort of like a military base using police. That's what I'm getting from the news reports. But anything you want to speak to us?
No, you're not the only person. I've heard a lot of citizens raising concerns now about even law enforcement officers looking like 9/11, expecting another 9/11 tomorrow. We have special task force that handles things like that. Officers should receive as much safety equipment as possible. But at the same time, we have a greater responsibility, and that greater responsibilities means that we're going to police in a way that we're not frightening the citizens that we are sworn to protect and serve. And also, too, if you look at, we'll have to go down to Atlanta. If you look out throughout New Jersey and New York, specifically New Jersey, let me tell you about that. Police cars are now becoming more stealth looking. You can hardly see on the car that it says police. And that's totally contrary to the reason why we put cars in patrol patterns. We want people to see law enforcement vehicles. We want you to know the police are there. We've learned that that deters crime. Now, we could debate how much it deters crime, but it deters crime. And also, too, it makes communities feel safer when they see police patrolling the areas. Well, certain communities, you know, where we're going, the direction we're going in now, that's debatable with respect to some communities. But that's unfortunate, too. But, you know, we seem like we're creeping into a space that is going to more so isolate law enforcement from the communities that they have to serve. And if we're going to go down that track, it's not going to be good for law enforcement, nor is it going to be good for the community. So we have to really pay attention to that. And as I said, you can determine. They had a case in one of the council members in a city outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, had called me up. Originally from New Jersey, his brother is a retired law enforcement officer from New Jersey. And he called me up and he talked about the blue line going on police cars during the height of the George Floyd incident. And he said some citizens told him that that was offensive, you know. And so I told him, well, you have a judgment to make. You know, you have your citizens, your community, and you want them to feel comfortable. So you have to exercise your judgment, you know, as a councilman. But, you know, as I say, and I will always say, and I'm not just saying this anecdotally, there's empirical data to support the fact that when community and police partner to address community crime problems, crime rates go down and community police partnerships climb.
Okay. Well, we don't have much time left, but this has been really good. It's been very instructive. And I hope the audience would agree. It's interesting when you talk about police being visible. You know, I grew up in public housing in the city of Newark, and we didn't see any police officers until after the rebellion of 1967, the civil disturbance. We didn't see them. There was no reason because we handled it ourselves. The Nation of Islam served as our facilitator. So it's only after the influence of drugs and later guns and things like that, that people got this fear. And then when 9/11 came, it seems like everybody got really fear. As a matter of fact, talking about language is interesting because I hear people when they say, be safe. And we never said be safe. We said, see you later. It was a much more positive when you left people. It wasn't like, okay, I mean, I see you again. So it's really interesting that now we've gotten to a point where the community has to see police in some form to make them feel safe. So anyway, I wanted to kind of close out a little bit about, to talk briefly about community policing, because if we're going to see police, it should be old school community policing, but a lot of people don't know what that is because they've not experienced, especially if they're 50 years old and younger. So if you can speak to that about what we should see and what we should expect, I think that the audience would really appreciate it.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that issue up because community policing is so critical. But what we've been able to do, what law enforcement has, some law enforcement agencies have gone in the direction of, is giving a party for kids, going on a trip with the Boy Scouts, taking people to the basketball games or something, some kids from underserved communities. That is not community policing. All right. I mean, it could be a segment of community policing, but community policing is specifically when the community, law enforcement, the business community, and other community collaboratives sit down at a table together. And this is generally, we find that it's more sustainable when it's led by the community, when they sit down at a table together and decide on what is the best method of policing or serving those respective communities. That's true community policing. And we know it works. As I said earlier, there's empirical data to support it. So why are we not going in that direction? You know, I'm a little miffed as to the reason why we continually not to go in that direction. Quite frankly, I think we're going in the opposite direction now, which is going to be not the results that we're looking for. So that's true community policing. When you have these businesses in town, I'll use Newark, for example, you have Prudential at the table, you have Panasonic at the table, you have PSC&G at the table, you have clergy at the table, you have community groups at the table. And it doesn't have to be people who you always agree with. Unfortunately, we like to sit at the table with people we feel comfortable with. Sometimes you need to be at the table with people you feel uncomfortable with in order to get to the right solutions. So that's, I know our time is short, but that's a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what community policing should be. But I invite people, don't just take my word, go to the Department of Community, Department of Justice, community, cops office, community oriented policing services. And there's a clear cut definition there. And if we apply that, I have a lot of faith in believing that that's going to be effective. It was implemented in Newark recently in a real way. In Newark, homicides have reduced by over 50%. So there is a living example of what Mayor Raz Baraka is doing in Newark as it relates to implementing an effective community policing program.
I'm going to thank Commissioner Giles for doing this interview. He and I do programs. We've been doing them on a regular basis, haven't we, Commissioner, over the years. So I really want to thank him. I think that the information he's provided has been instructive. It's our responsibility in terms of our civic capacity to follow up, to make those phone calls, let people know that we have the information, that we're going to be watching them, because if we don't, we're just giving them the power. And on that note, and Commissioner, you mentioned Adam Clayton Powell, what's in your hand? And so Michael's going to end the program with Adam Clayton Powell's speech, what's in your hand? Thank you. Thank you to the audience. Thank you to Michael for, you know, helping me out all the time, for Gloria Brown Marshall giving me this opportunity. And I want to say I really encourage people who are listening to this program to donate to WBAI so you can hear people like the commissioner who bring information, not only giving you information and instructive information, but telling you what you can do. So you can write down in your notes, this is what I need to do today to make things happen. I have power. So on that note, Adam Clayton Powell, what's in your hand? Thank you, Commissioner. And thank you, Michael.
Well, as I know,
take care.
Yeah, you're thank in you trouble. Where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand?
It's a new day. It's a new life for me. Yeah, it's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly.
La iniciativa Visión Cero le recuerda que el exceso de velocidad arruina vidas. Conductores, estén pendientes de los peatones y ciclistas y al doblar, reduzcan la velocidad a 5 millas por hora.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.